You are listening to New Music Box from New Music USA, presented in collaboration with DubLab Radio as part of a series where we feature conversations, DJ mixes, articles, and live performances that explore the current landscape of music composition.
Hello, this is Chandler Poling, the host of Studio Soundtracks for DubLab Radio. I have the great pleasure of leading such an important topic of discussion today on behalf of DubLab and New Music USA. I was challenged with the question of who gets to compose from DubLab's executive director, Alejandro Cohen, and given the opportunity to explore the topic of music composition and what it looks like. We often don't look into classical or neoclassical composition. We hear it. But there is a common stigmatism in music composition that we are here to address. It's commonly thought that music composition is written by older white men. Instantly, when we listen to classical music, we picture those paintings of Beethoven or Mozart, or images of Edward Elgar, Aaron Copland, and John Williams. I'm joined by composer Shonda Dancy to discuss this topic about the modern composer and what the career looks like nowadays. Shonda is known for her work in film and television, including the Sundance Award-winning documentary Aftershock, the Netflix series The Defeated, and the soon-to-release Korean war epic from Sony Pictures titled Devotion. She was named by Arts Boston as one of the 10 contemporary black composers you should know today. Welcome, Shonda. So happy to be with you today.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Well, I'm really happy to have this discussion with you. And I would love for you just to tell me about your musical upbringing. Did you always know you'd be a composer?
Well, from pretty early on, actually. So the music side comes from my mom's side of the family. So my mother's mother was actually a classical musician. She was a pianist, a composer, and an opera singer. And so she taught me piano, probably around the age of three. And that's where, you know, the love really just started flourishing. And then I started playing violin at eight, and I started composing in middle school, so around 12 or so. And it was high school. By senior year of high school, I had decided that I definitely wanted to be a composer, but, you know, I didn't really make the film scoring connection just yet, but I just knew that I wanted to, like, compose for orchestras and things like that. My mother's brothers would make fun of me. They were the scientists of the family. They would say, like, oh, you want to be the next Beethoven kind of thing. And I'm like, oh, I'm not thinking about that. I just, you know, I just want to create for orchestra. So, yeah, it was pretty early.
What is it about orchestra that excites you?
Well, I mean, I play violin, so I've always played in orchestras since I was a kid. And so when you're sitting on stage and you're playing these beautiful pieces, like, you're surrounded by all of everyone's sound waves, and there's something really extraordinary about it. It is like, for lack of a better term, like a drug. You know, the emotion that you're able to convey through sound waves just by reading dots on a page always fascinated me. And so that's just how I had always expressed myself musically. So
yeah, wonderful. I can relate only from concert band in high school, but I loved being in the ensemble. And yeah, that feeling of almost community with the kind of joining of everybody on stage is really, really exciting.
Yes. And then, you know, when you're performing for, you know, live audience, like, the audience gets into it, and like it's just a room filled with humans that are, you know, sharing this experience, and it's something that's beyond, almost beyond the physical.
Exactly. Now, were your parents supportive, family supportive? Obviously, if your mom comes from a musical background, I'm sure were they just like, oh, our little Shonda is going to be a composer?
Totally. My parents, they were like, whatever makes you happy, you know, honestly. Like, they put up with my terrible violin playing when I was, you know, first learning, you know, they bought me, you know, a keyboard, and I'm just like writing little songs, even when I was like in elementary school, not really, you know, thinking, oh, I'm composing stuff, but, you know, just having fun and, you know, improvising kind of thing. And yeah, they were always like, yeah, that's what Shonda does. You know, it just wasn't. There was no question. There was, you know, I never had any sort of like, well, you should be a doctor or a lawyer or this at all. There was none of that. So I can't even conceptualize not, you know, having a life of being a musician slash composer, because that's how it always was. So.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, that speaks to that familial support that
exactly.
young children, when they get that. And yes. and I know there's all sorts of organizations like Education Through Music and whatnot that encourage music education with young children. And I love that. I love that when parents are supportive in that world. My father's a musician. I was encouraged to be a musician. I am not, but...
but you're doing your thing. That's yes. what matters. Yeah. so, yes.
But I do... I love the support that mm-hmm. the option was there, the, you know, the encouragement.
Yeah.
Who were some of your musical influences growing up, and who do you look up to nowadays?
Okay. So growing up, I was obsessed with Antonin Dvorak, Igor Stravinsky, Dmitri Shostakovich, Bela Bartok, John Williams. Yeah, really all of the Russian rousing composers, yes. you know, Rimsky-Korsakov, Tchaikovsky, like, you know, yes, that was my bread and butter. And then also throw in, like, you know, amazing contemporary composers like Joe Hisaishi and, you know, things like that. And yeah, those have been, they're still my heroes yeah. to this day. So I don't think I've really changed much, you know, as far as like... you know, who were my heroes growing up and now, like, they're the same.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Even some of those names elicit kind of goosebumps.
Really, right? It's, you know, yeah. it's like, that's like, to me, that's like the soul of music is, you know, there. So yeah. At least, you know, the music that I like. So let's be, you know, because music is very universal and subjective, and I'm not going to say like certain types of music are better than others. It's just... what I gravitated to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I know that Japanese animation or anime is mm-hmm. an influence for you. And I wanted to know, what is it about that medium that inspires your creativity?
Oh, man. So anime just allows you to use your full imagination and the full range of emotions. There's no limit. So some of the best scores are like, you have like these themes that are... these fully singable themes, and it's okay. It's okay to be sentimental. Mm-hmm. It's okay to be dramatic. Mm-hmm. It's okay to be, you know, brooding. You know, you're not grounded in reality. You're not trying to be grounded in reality. So it's always been just fascinating for me, just listening to any anime soundtrack and any style, you know. I mean, Yoko Kanno, like, you know, yes. with Cowboy Bebop. I mean,
incredible.
Yeah, you know, and she does everything, and it's like, you know, and she just goes hard, you know, for all the styles. So, yeah. And, you know, I already mentioned Joe Hisaishi, you know, and like, and then video game scores. Let's not forget, you
yes.
know, Final Fantasy, mm-hmm. Nobuo Uematsu. I mean, come on. I yeah. grew up on, you know, those soundtracks. So, yeah, man, like, it's kind of embedded in my soul right along with Dmitri Shostakovich. So, yeah.
That's. Yeah. I think, you know, being also a fan of anime and part of that community, I was first introduced to the term the feels.
Yeah.
The feels. You have the feels when you hear this music. Yes. And it was related to an American animated series called Avatar: The Last Airbender.
Yes.
And there is a song called, I think, Brave Little Soldier Boy or Little Soldier Boy that is sung in that. And like, yeah, you could hear the first like three notes
and you're
instantly
there. Just bawling. You're like,
yeah, that, yeah. The hyper kind of emotionality of that music is incredible
yes.
to experience.
Yes.
And I think it kind of transcends like some of the modern filmmaking that shies away from it and wants atmospheric.
Exactly.
Is really interesting exactly. choice because there is something to be said about that immediate emotional reaction that comes from music that you remember.
Exactly. Yeah.
So mm-hmm. This topic about modern composer, I'm just curious what you think about it. Do you find yourself with pencil and staff paper at a piano creating melodies to do your work? Like,
I use all methods. Definitely pencil and paper is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely singing into my iPhone. The whole idea of what we were just talking about, Japanese anime, like how like you have these singable melodies. And I sing into my iPhone like something that comes from the ether. And then, you know, I'll translate it to paper and then translate it to Pro Tools kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, there's so many tools that are available to composers now. And also depending on, like, you know, how quickly you have to get things done. So, like, you know, film composers, you know, it's pretty common that we'll have some pretty crazy deadlines. So, you know, you can't necessarily, like, just do pen to paper and then to finale and then to, you know, you kind of have to just go straight to Pro Tools to picture, you know? Yeah. So, but all avenues are valid, you know, whichever way you can get the sounds that are in your head, because they're already in your head, mm-hmm. essentially, mm-hmm. And out into the world is, like, you know, the best way. So
because I think when people think of a composer, I'm just going to generalize the public, mm-hmm. They think of a composer that is, you know, at their piano, not keyboard, but, you know, like, mm-hmm. piano, mm-hmm. and this very classic piano, yeah. grand piano, the very classic kind of, you know, pencil to paper. But what I've found is most composers I meet are almost like tech wizards. They are so smart with technology, yes. and plugins and gear. And what is that kind of experience of learning all of this technical side to a very acoustically, you know, totally. Historic medium?
Yes, totally. So I'm huge into computers. Like, all of my computers that I use for composing have been, like, custom built by me. Like, I open them up, and even some of my desktops from scratch, like, everything, you know, built, tailored specifically to what I would need. It really does help to have a tech background, mm-hmm. Especially, you know, in the scenario that I explained before, like, you know, with film composers, we have, like, these crazy deadlines. So if you have, mm-hmm. like, templates already set up, you know, this is the big orchestral template, and this is the more atmospheric template, and this is the rock template, you know, kind of thing. And you have these things already set up from a technological, you know, standpoint, then you can get the notes out quicker and to the producers quicker. So, yeah, I mean, you know, for people who are interested in composing, it's, you know, the tech tools are awesome. You know, you don't have to shy away, you know, if that's your thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, of course, there's many different ways to
exactly.
create music. Exactly. So there's no correct way. But I do think that there is a general consensus in the public that they don't quite understand all of the technology that composers have at their tool shed, so to speak, that they can use to create the more atmospheric sounds, the more sound designy mm-hmm. sounds that go into film composition rather than just piano and orchestra. Mm-hmm. So the role of a film composer is, of course, much different than a classical composer, because totally. I just wouldn't want to kind of judge your thoughts on that. Like, what do you think about the two roles of what the film composer versus the classical composer?
So, having been able to experience both sides of the fence, film composing, you know, it's a very, very much a collaborative effort. You are essentially a filmmaker along with your fellow filmmakers. You bring your specific skill to the film and the storytelling of the film. And it's important that the dramatic point of view that the whole filmmaking team wants to portray to the audience is achieved. Mm-hmm. Classical side is a lot more introspective, and it's more like what you want to say as an artist, and what you want to express to the audience. So you are essentially the sole, quote unquote, filmmaker, mm-hmm. you know, it's all your decisions and it's your timeline and things like that. So being a classical composer is a lot more freeing in that regard.
Yes.
But it doesn't necessarily mean one is better than the other, at least in my experience. Right. I love both. So,
but I guess there's different disciplines needed for both, in the sense of the collaborative nature
for sure.
of film composing.
Yes.
And the swallowing of pride.
Yes.
When
yes.
you write something that you love and somebody doesn't like it.
Yeah. That's something you definitely have to, like, you know, approach it like, it's okay if it doesn't work for everyone. Just, you know, make it work for everyone in the you know, the film composing world. But yeah, classical world. Doesn't work for everyone. Whatever. It's art. It's subjective. Yeah. Take it, you know? So, yeah. Definitely big difference.
Well, at the top of the show, you know, we talked about the visibility of composers. And I was curious, would you say Would you say the visibility of women composers has increased in your recent memory?
I really, 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 really think so. Really. So, you know, when I first moved to LA and first was doing the USC film scoring program, et cetera, like really the only female film composers that I knew were Laura Cartman, Wendy and Lisa, Deborah Lurie, and Rachel Portman. That's it. That's four people.
Wow.
That's four people that I knew of. And now I can't even count. Like there's a lot. And hundreds more, you know, so and more wonderful composers are coming forward with these great projects. Like there's so much content and so many projects, both in the film world and the classical world, that are showing women composers. And as well, like, you know, I turn on KUSC and like, you know, it's very, very common that I will hear like women composers and people of color, like composers. And it was just not like that in 2003 and before, you know? So, yeah, really, really excited about that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a wonderful, dawning of all this new talent that we get to experience. And yeah, I certainly have seen the visibility increase, and it's, but you're right, like from not even 20 years ago, less,
exactly.
You know, it was like went from count on one hand to now
exactly.
Countless, which yeah. is fantastic. What about Black composers?
Oh man. So like, I'm finding that, you know, so I did, you know, I knew of like Terrence Blanchard and, of course, Quincy Jones and, you know, and Catherine Bostick. And so, now it's like even more, you know, now we've got like, you know, Amanda Jones and Dara Taylor and Jermaine Stiegel and, you know, like and George Shaw and like all of these guys are like, we're all just like coming up, and there's just more and more, you know, people of color, Black composers that are getting these big projects and like, you know, really getting visibility. And Terrence Blanchard, you know, also did Met Opera with Casey Lemons. I mean, like huge things. Solange, doing Solange Knowles, doing a ballet. I mean, come on, like it's yes, it's really there's a very positive turning point that we're witnessing. So very happy about that.
That's wonderful. Do you feel the support from Hollywood for women and, you know, composers of color is, do you feel like it's a trend to fill a quota, or do you think it's here to stay?
I can't say for sure, but for me right now, it feels like it's here to stay because people, well, I say this because people of color composers are not being pigeonholed to do the thing that's their stereotypical cultural thing. Michael Abels is not doing, you know, stereotypical things. Like, yeah, and Jean-Yves Bontemps, you know, we're doing, you know, what's considered the standard lexicon, you know. And there's a lot more executives and filmmakers that just grew up that way, like with a more diverse, you know, upbringing, diverse group of friends. And we know in the film industry, it's kind of like, you know, your group of friends all stay together and they get big together, you know? So when your group of friends is already diverse, you know, that's staying power, you know?
Yeah.
It's not like you're hiring strangers just to tick a box. It's like, yeah, that's my homie from USC. Of course, I'm gonna like, you know, hire them, kind of thing. So, yeah, I think this is staying power. I think so.
Excellent, so. Wonderful. My last question for you is kind of a bit of a downer, but it's a topic that I really wanted to address because I think it's important. It's the Sundance Institute. They recently halted their composer labs, which kind of really destroyed me. And
yes.
I wanted to know, what did the labs mean to you when you went through those Sundance composer labs, and how do you think this will impact the industry?
So I can say without a doubt that the Sundance lab was kind of like one of those fork in the road moments where like it happens and it created a road for me to actually reach where I am now. And it's meeting the right people And when I say meeting the right people, I mean like making friends
yeah.
with other brilliant, like-minded people that are making great works of art, you know? And so like, you know, one of my best friends in the whole world I met at the Sundance Labs, Jonathan Wysocki, he is, you know, one of my best friends and an amazingly talented filmmaker, Dramarama, go watch it. Anyway, I just can't imagine not having, you know, something like that in my musical career and life. I mean, all, it's, you know, the support of Peter Golub and like just all of like, you know, the Sundance posse, you know. Mm-hmm. I hope it comes back yeah. because that's just tragic.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, for a little bit of context for the audience, the Sundance Composers Lab had been going on a good 30 more plus years, mm-hmm. you know, bringing composers and filmmakers together in an experimental kind of lab, and then you mm-hmm. guys would forge friendships. But what they really led was kind of duality by having women, men, composers of color part of the program by design, so that when you go through the program, you come out and then you guys have all this additional knowledge going into the film composing world. So that was canceled. So yes, I also hope that it returns.
Yeah.
But on a brighter note, tell me what you have coming up.
Well, coming up, I think I can say it because it has been posted on Instagram. So the amazing Sony biopic of Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody. Just finished scoring that in Nashville over this past weekend. So I just got back in LA yesterday. Really, really excited for everyone
yes.
to see this.
Oh, good.
So, yeah.
Marvelous. Yeah. Wonderful.
I think that's all I can talk about. There's other things, but, you know.
Yes. No worries. Well, I look forward to seeing Whitney. We look forward to seeing Devotion when it mm-hmm. comes out over Thanksgiving weekend. And thank you so much for joining me on this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you, Chandler.
Thank you, New Music USA. This was great.
All right. Thank you, New Music USA, for sure. And thanks, DubLab.
This program was produced by DubLab and supported by New Music USA and featured on New Music Box. Additional programs and more details available at newmusicusa.org and dublab.com.